Broadcast Studios. This is ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
Thank you for joining us today on ABQ Connect. I have a young man that's going to join us on the program right now. His name is Phil Davies. He is a staff attorney for the Raices Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services in San Antonio, Texas. Phil, welcome to ABQ Connect. How are you?
Hey, Jim. Yeah, thank you for having me. Great to be with you.
Well, I've got to brag about Phil. One of the last things I heard from Phil his senior year was that I didn't cause him any permanent emotional damage when I helped coach for the basketball team. I've shared with our audience, Phil, that I've yelled at basketball officials for a really long time and finally was able to break that habit here about 5-6 years ago. So sorry that didn't happen in my time with you, but it probably would have been beneficial. Sounds like you've done great. I'm very proud of you. You've done a great job. Of course, Cindy and Pat, your parents are very close friends and your whole family's doing great. I don't know where your brothers are because you've got, how many brothers do you have? Two?
I have two brothers.
Two brothers.
One is in Seattle and one is in Albuquerque working as a special ed teacher.
That's great. That's great. Well, Phil, the reason I wanted you on the program is because ABQ Connect, our show, we are doing a lot of community discussion type things. We, of course, look at things from a Christian worldview, but we have a lot of people that are not necessarily believers. We have people of other religions. We've had, you know, just really interesting guests, people that are part of our community. We've been part of encouraging churches to come together to help people and do different things. But when I start talking to the Democrats and I start talking to the Republicans and I ask them about immigration and these issues that come up and are so widely publicized across the country, you know, building walls, improving the immigration thing, letting whoever that wants to come in the country, you know, it's about to make my head explode because I don't know what the truth is. And so I'm so glad that you are joining us because, as I understand it, Phil, you've worked on the government side of this problem, and now you're working for a private nonprofit. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I started my career with the DOJ, actually working in the immigration courts here in Texas, and then recently transitioned to working with Raices, as you said, which is the largest immigration nonprofit in Texas and one of the largest organizations of our kind in the whole country. So I hope I am able to provide some balanced view for you on the immigration issues. I think you touched on something already in that everyone has a different perspective on this issue, but there's so many sort of sub-issues within it. So I think it's really easy to get a hardline opinion about a certain topic when the thing that you might be speaking about is totally unrelated. So I think whenever we speak about immigration, there's so many nuanced sub-issues that it's really worth highlighting where one issue ends and another one begins, or else you sort of end up talking in circles.
Well, and Phil, I know that you have a heart for people. I mean, that's one of the reasons you're in the immigration law field is because you care about people, and you obviously care about people that are not necessarily part of your ethnic background. And I think that's an amazing thing. I call that a God thing. I call that, you know, when people are vocationally just interested in helping people, I mean, that's just an amazing thing. So I compliment you on that. Phil, tell us a little bit about Raices and what you do and how the organization operates.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you, first of all, for the compliment and for just the overall positivity that you've expressed towards me and my career, especially growing up as a young man, as you said, getting so much loud encouragement from you, I think has shown echoes in my career. And I'm happy to carry some of those lessons that I learned from you as a basketball coach in my career. I would say, so Raices obviously stands for Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, like you said. It was formerly the Refugee Assistance Project. And our main goal is to help people who find themselves in the guts of the immigration bureaucracy in deportation proceedings or just trying to figure out their paperwork. So we have offices all around the state of Texas. We're doing work in immigration detention centers, in family detention centers. The work that I do is primarily with low-income folks who are trying to work their way through the affirmative immigration system, meaning that they're applying to get a green card or they're trying to sponsor their spouse to come over from whatever country, or they find themselves in immigration proceedings themselves and need an attorney to represent them in front of the immigration court.
And Phil, is the process laborious? I mean, I don't want to, you know, put anybody down, but one of the things that I get frustrated with is just going to the Department of Motor Vehicles. Now they have improved exponentially, but I complain when I spend, you know, 3 hours somewhere where I think it should take 15 minutes. I can't imagine this process taking years. And tell us about that.
Yeah. I mean, laborious is the right word to use. I think there's so much bureaucracy and there's so much volume within the system. I think people underestimate just how many people are actually working their ways through the guts of the immigration bureaucracy and are either in immigration court, you know, fighting their deportation proceedings, or they've been waiting years and years for a family-based petition, or basically any small thing that needs to be done within the immigration system is months, years, or decades long in the procedural processing times. So laborious is certainly the word to use. I think thinking of immigration law more in step with the tax code or another area of law in which there's, you know, thousands and thousands of treatises of information about how to operate within the system is really the right way to frame it.
Phil, what is a normal process? Let's say that you are a resident of Mexico and you want to come into the United States, or you're a resident of South America and you make your way all the way up to the border. What is the legal process that people are required to take now?
Sure. So the legal process that one would take to migrate to the United States from their home country would be going through the U.S. consulate. You would be sponsored by either a family member who's petitioning for you here in the United States or an employer who's petitioning for you here in the United States. Those are the areas that our immigration system prioritizes. So if you were someone from Mexico and you had a spouse that was here in the United States, they would petition for you through a process called the I-130 with U.S. Customs and Immigration Services. Once that was approved, you would have an interview at the consulate in Mexico. They would look through all your records. They would judge your eligibility to migrate based on criteria like your ability to speak the language, your ability to not be a public charge, meaning that you're not going to come into the United States and immediately be on welfare, things like that. So that's generally the legal process. I think what a lot of people don't understand is that you need a sponsor to come to the United States legally. So there isn't just a line that you can get into if you're just a regular person from Mexico or Guatemala. You would need to have someone that is in the United States that is a U.S. citizen sponsor you, and even in that process, it takes years. So the idea of just showing up to the border and asking to be let in is not one that is readily available. What we do have are humanitarian protections, and that's where we get into asylum and refugee law. So an asylee is someone who is displaced from their home country because they have a well-founded fear of persecution, to use the legal language, meaning that they're going to be persecuted, physically harmed because of their membership in a particular social group, or their race, or their religion, or some immutable characteristics such as that.
Phil, when you talk about, it sounds like most of your clients are coming in to this country based on these humanitarian type grounds. Is that true?
Yeah, I would say that the majority of the people that Raices works with are working their way through the humanitarian grounds. Most of the people that I see are actually people who have been in the country for years but came illegally. So I work with a lot of DACA folks and a lot of people who crossed illegally but have been in the States for years and are trying to get their paperwork sorted out from within the country. But overall, yes, we represent people who are in the asylum proceedings. And I think it's worth a note here that immigration court doesn't have a public defender system because it's not part of the legislative, or it's not part of the judicial branch of government. It's part of the executive. So they don't have the same rights to an attorney as someone who finds themselves in the court system the United States would have. So immigration nonprofits are kind of bear the burden of helping people sort out the process. There is no kind of government representation for folks that are working through the system.
And Phil, how is your organization funded? Do you receive funding from the government or private donations? How does that work?
We do receive some government funding, particularly with grants. And some of the work that we're able to do in immigration detention centers is thanks to grants from places like the city of Austin and the city of San Antonio. But most of our funding comes from private donations. Raices actually gained quite a bit of notoriety during the beginning of the Trump administration and Jeff Sessions' time with the DOJ. There was the zero tolerance era, which resulted in a lot of family separation. I don't know if you remember this.
I do.
This whole kind of crisis. RISIS was really the boots on the ground to respond to that problem. And we got tons and tons of donation thanks to successful social media campaigns that I think has really led the charge for the way nonprofits are doing fundraising these days. So we've been able to carry a lot of the momentum that we got from very successful social media fundraisers.
So today, a refugee or somebody immigrating or coming across the border, I guess is a way I hear it spoken, without going through the proper procedures, they're no longer separated from their families. The children are no longer taken away. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true for now, which is something that I like to point out didn't happen on its own. I think there was some tireless advocacy by our group and others to really ring the alarm bell about that problem and to put pressure on the government to make that system more humanitarian.
Well, tell us again, just for our listeners' sake and for my sake, how is the process of immigration with a visa? How is that different than the process for refugees?
Sure. So I think it'd be useful to define what a refugee is versus an asylee. So a refugee is just someone who is displaced from their home country or their native lands for various reasons, but usually to do with persecution of people who have an immutable characteristic such as them. So these are people who are moving not by their choice is really the right way to think about it. An asylee is a refugee that's at the door knocking and wanting to be let in. So refugee and asylee are essentially the same thing, except for the geographical caveat that an asylee is here and they want to be let in because they say that they will be unsafe in the place that they're from. And there's a large body of international law that applies to the way that various countries treat asylees and refugees. The way that we handle people who are coming through the visa system is that someone would be sponsored by an employer or a family member, and they would interview at the consulate. The way that our system is prioritized is for family reunification. So that's kind of the base level thing that U.S. immigration law prioritizes, which makes sense because we don't want to split up families. You know, if we have an international marriage where a United States citizen has married someone from Mexico, it makes sense for us to keep that family together. So for humanitarian reasons, we don't want to make it so burdensome to be with your loved one. But we also don't want to lose our United States citizens by them having to move to the country of their family member. So that's what our system prioritizes mainly.
But Phil, you've said even though I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Sure.
Go forward.
You know, and the thing that's confusing about that system is that the direct relatives, there isn't really a cap on the amount of people that can come in through that system each year. But with indirect relatives, there is a very strict cap. So no country can receive more than 7% of the overall visas that are issued in a year. So that means that there are huge wait lists for countries like Mexico, for countries like China, Philippines, India, places that send a lot of people every year to the United States. So when you hear folks say that, you know, people should legally immigrate, they should get in line in their home country and go through the process that you're describing can be as long as a decade or more.
Oh, goodness. I mean, what do they do during that decade?
A lot of them migrate elsewhere, and we lose valuable talent in our workforce, particularly for that. The way that our employment visas are also capped really stringently, and you know, if it's a 20-year wait list to come from India to get your visa to the United States, but it's a 2-year wait list to get to New Zealand from India, you'll take your software programming degree there instead of waiting in line for the United States.
I am on the phone this afternoon with Phil Davies. He is a graduate of Hope Christian School in Albuquerque, New Mexico, has a lot of family still here, lives in San Antonio, Texas, and he works for RAISIS, Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services in San Antonio, Texas. We're talking about immigrating to this country, immigrating legally, coming in as a refugee, as I believe you use the word asylee, is that correct?
Yeah,
is that correct? We're going to have a lot more with Phil. Phil, we got to take a quick break and say thank you to our sponsors for underwriting the program here on KNKT. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Gonset Physical Medicine specializes in the diagnosis and treatment of spinal ligament injury. Don't ignore the pain and discomfort any longer. Schedule a consultation today at gonsted-nm.com or 505-884-8584.
A strong marriage can change a couple, a community, and a culture. Join us at Calvary Church for the Marriage Enrichment Workshop on Friday, August 14th and Saturday, August 15th. Discover your relationship strengths and growth areas with a pre-workshop online evaluation by Prepare Enrich that includes stress, communication, intimacy, and more. Then enjoy guided couple and small group discussions and exercises as you develop a plan to move forward. The cost for this workshop is $95 and space is limited. Sign up by Monday, August 3rd at calvarynm.church.
A judgment call. This is Roger Patterson with a minute of Vision for Life. During week 4 of the NFL's 2015 campaign, Lions wide receiver Calvin Johnson was about to score the game-winning touchdown on a quick pass from Matthew Stafford. Just before the goal line, he was hit by Seahawks Cam Chancellor, resulting in the ball being fumbled into the end zone. As it was about to bounce out of the back of the end zone, Seahawks linebacker KJ Wright illegally batted the ball right in front of the referee. The Tuesday morning radio talk was that it was a judgment call, but if this action had been penalized, the Lions would have had it first and goal at the half-yard line. The referee's poor judgment cost the Lions another opportunity. KJ Wright's poor judgment could have cost his team the game. Poor judgment costs us something, doesn't it? When it comes to the adulterous affair that you may be considering, listen to the words of Proverbs 6:22. It states, "But a man who commits adultery lacks judgment. Whoever does so destroys himself."
You've been listening to Dr. Roger Patterson with A Minute of Vision, a ministry of Vision for Life Radio.
You're listening to KNKT. Welcome back to ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
We are on the phone this afternoon with Phil Davies. He's a staff attorney for the RAISIS Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services in San Antonio, Texas. We're talking about immigrants into this country. Phil, as you know, in Albuquerque, we have both a lot of legal and illegal immigrants in Albuquerque. They're working at various jobs. They're doing different things. So in the rest of our time together today, we're going to talk about a lot of different subjects, but I want to get back to this 10-year, this decade-long process of even doing this legally. The question I have is really relative to, you know, one side of the political parties want to blame everything on the incumbent party in the White House. But this has really been going on for a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, a lot has changed, especially in terms of enforcement with the immigration laws under the Trump administration. But you're right to point out that this is a mess that's decades in the making, not 3 years, 4 years. I think one thing that's really instructive when you think about the development of immigration law in the country is to think about the development of the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security is a government system that did not exist before 9/11. And then post 9/11, it was the Bush administration's idea to bring together different government agencies that they didn't feel were talking to each other enough. And the main kind of apparatus that developed out of the Homeland Security conglomeration was ICE, CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, and Customs and Immigration Services. So everything within immigration got developed into one kind of big mesh with the development of the Department of Homeland Security. And we've seen tremendous budget increases for DHS over the past few years and over the past few decades.
Phil, how does the process of immigration in our country compare to other countries?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that there's this sense that the immigration should be fixed, or that there's an immigration problem to be fixed in this country. But I think even a cursory look at other nations and their own immigration problems will reveal that immigration is a debate that's being had all around the world about the ways to bring in people into your society, your humanitarian objectives, your economic objectives, and how those realities meet. So a system like the one that exists in Canada or Australia, which is something that the Trump administration was looking to when they initially took office, uses point systems to judge whether people will be in the visa running or not. So they're not as concerned with family reunification. They're more concerned with looking at whether or not people have collegiate education and they get a certain amount of points for that, or if they do have a family member, they get a certain amount of points for that. So there are different ways to scale how you're measuring the people that you are planning on bringing into your country. The way that it's developed in Europe has been quite different from the United States. Obviously, Europe is a quite different place from the United States, but there's the borders have really kind of come down with the implementation of the Schengen agreements, and there's been more widespread immigration between the European nations as a continent. And they're dealing with a very similar refugee asylee problem that we are, with the increase in people coming from Syria and from broken states in Northern Africa. And then you have the extreme sides of immigration policy that you see in places like the Gulf states, like Qatar, where there is such a small percentage of the people that actually live in those states who are citizens of those places. And there are huge, huge underclasses of workers, of foreign-born workers. So the United States is definitely not unique in its cocktail of misery that leads to the immigration system that we have right now.
Phil, this is off script, but I've got to ask you, because you've worked on both sides. You've worked on the federal government side, and now you're working on the nonprofit side. You've worked directly with people that are involved in this process. Do you have some ideas about how we could improve this system? Is there a way to do that?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of just bureaucratic inefficiencies that I think would be pretty down the middle, no political opinion needed. These are things that we need to fix. The amount of people that have a pending immigration in the United States right now is over 1 million. There's not nearly enough immigration judges or immigration staff within the Department of Justice to adjudicate all those cases. So we're seeing backlogs of, you know, 5, 6, 7 years for people that are in immigration proceedings. So I think obviously hiring more immigration judges, more DOJ personnel to adjudicate those cases is a good place to start. I think looking towards what is pushing people to immigrating to the United States, particularly from the humanitarian side, why is Central America sending so many people to the United States? Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, places in the Northern Triangle, as we call it, are sending huge amounts of people who are seeking humanitarian assistance here in the United States because of the systemic violence and corruption that they've experienced in their home country. So I think having an idea that enforcement may have its place in the U.S. immigration system, but looking towards stemming the flows of migration by addressing some of the problems on the ground in those countries with diplomatic intervention is something that I'm a big advocate for.
Well, there's two ideas I jotted down while you were talking there. And again, Phil, I'm going off script here, but I want to, like, for example, you mentioned let's address some of the systemic issues in some of these other countries, motivating people to flee those countries and come to the United States. Well, I think about, you know, I don't necessarily agree with their politics, but I look at an organization like Starbucks, and I understand that they have operations in Colombia, huge coffee farms where they set up clean water, clean housing. They compensate people that work on these farms growing coffee and have a great expertise. They've been doing it for hundreds of years, and even it's a family tradition a lot of times. But Starbucks is basically organized a way for them to make a living and be safe and have medical care and do all kinds of different things. I mean, is that the type of thing you're talking about?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I think that giving people durable solutions to the very real economic and security concerns that they face in their home country is the way forward. And I think, enforcement kind of ends up being a band-aid or a placebo or somewhere in between as far as actually fixing the problems that are showing up at our border. I think that you're right to point out Starbucks and other sort of private enterprises taking some responsibility. I'm not just putting the onus on this solely on the government. I think private enterprise that benefit from immigrant labor, that benefit from internationalism and the and transnationalism of the goods that they buy and sell, they do have a responsibility to set up some sustainable living situations for the people that are making those products. And I think when you look at the Northern Triangle, particularly with the example of coffee, you'll see how much coffee comes from those places that is extracted in straight up unfair ways.
Mm. And again, I know that there's some conscientious people trying to make sure that products are not produced with child labor and things that would go against the principles and laws of our country, but that's not really true all the time, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. You know, another thing that I wanted to speak about in terms of immigration fixes, I think in terms of illegal immigration, so people who are coming across the border from the Rio Grande or wherever they're coming across. So many of these folks see the help wanted sign in America for temporary agriculture work. And I think that the current system that we have for granting temporary visas for people who are doing temporary agriculture work is just not really working for us at all. And, you know, we had a program in the 1950s in which we added temporary work visas, and we saw tremendous drops in the amount of illegal immigration and border apprehensions from people who are crossing illegally, because people see the opportunity to come work, and U.S. employers will hire those folks. So to not have a workable temporary agricultural visa system, to me, is nonsensical.
Now, I've heard that there's an argument that criminals were coming across and they're not really working. They're just, hiding in this country now, and that's why they kind of disband those type of programs. Does that have any validity?
Yeah, I think that there's obviously the problem of organized crime and transnational crime, particularly in areas of drug smuggling. I do think that the notion that immigrant communities or that that people coming across the border are particularly dangerous, I think, is generally ill-founded. I think whether or not we want to admit it, I think it's frequently rooted in xenophobia more than it is in statistics. And a 2015 study in National Academy of Sciences said that immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than native-born citizens, and immigrant neighborhoods are generally safer than native neighborhoods. So there are statistics that point to various sides of the problem that you're discussing. But, I'm definitely not blind to the fact that transnational gangs and that organized crime coming across the border presents its own unique security challenges and presents something that we should have an eye out for when we're screening for visa applicants as they're going through the system that would ideally be in place. But I think that problem is frequently overblown.
We are on the phone this afternoon with Phil Davies. He's a staff attorney for the RAISIS Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services in San Antonio, Texas. We've got a lot more to talk to Phil about and probably not as much time as I would like. Phil, stay with us. We'll be back after saying thank you to our commercial sponsors. We'll be right back.
Are you looking to take your life's purpose to a whole new level? Calvary College is now offering on-site classes in biblical studies at Calvary Church of Albuquerque. And the next term starts August 17th. You can combine on-site and online classes to fit your life and your schedule. Plus, Calvary College partners with Veritas International University and Calvary Chapel University to give you options and flexibility, whether you're working toward an accredited degree or simply want to increase your knowledge of God's Word. On-site classes
courses include theology, church history, and worldview apologetics, both undergraduate and graduate level, all starting August 17th. Apply today at calvaryabq.college. That's calvaryabq.college.
I'm Rob Sneed, General Manager at Power Ford. If you're tired of old school gimmicks and games while shopping for a new car, then experience something new school at Power Ford. You'll get none of the hocus pocus, hokey pokey stuff the other guys try to pull. So here's the deal. We'll beat any new Ford deal in New Mexico, or we'll put $1,000 cash in your pocket. Come see why others rated us Best of the City and Ford Dealer of the Year. Find your ride at MyPowerFord.com or come see us. We're on the affordable side of Albuquerque, on Montaña, west of I-25.
Call 888-243-8183 for details.
Here's Mike Fabares, Bible teacher on Focal Point.
You know, when God called Moses to lead Israel's exodus from Egypt, his response was less than enthusiastic. If you'll remember, Moses attempted to resist God's call by reminding God of all the resources he didn't possess. I don't have the reputation. I don't have the credibility. I can't speak eloquently enough. But God wanted Moses to take inventory with a different perspective. It wasn't about what Moses didn't have. It was about God's ability to use what Moses did have. And when we step up to the task, even a simple shepherd's stick becomes the staff of God. So stop trying to remind God of what you don't have. Trust Him today to take what you do have to fulfill His calling on your life.
Right thinking leads to right living. Want more? Power up with Pastor Mike Fabares on Focal Point, a half hour of hard-hitting Bible teaching here on your station. Or check it out online at focalpointradio.org.
On KNKT, this is ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
Phil Davies, he is an attorney, an immigration attorney for Reasis Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services in San Antonio, Texas. Phil, I've got to play off my next couple questions off a couple things you've said. They're not on the little list of questions that we kind of put together to talk about today, but I have to ask them. I want to kind of ask you about the budget math. How many refugees right now are in your immigrant center now in San Antonio?
So that's a hard number to pin down as far as people that we are actually working with. The amount of people who are in the immigration detention centers across southern Texas would be in the area of about 2,000. And so that's the amount of people that we would ideally be able to help. But the amount of people that we actually get to, is only a fraction of that, unfortunately.
Well, and of course, that all has to do with funding and other things. So who is paying the bill to keep these people safe and put a roof over their heads and three squares a day for 2,000 people? Who's paying that bill?
That would formerly be the Department of Homeland Security. The way that the Trump administration has structured the asylum process right now is that they've implemented something called the Migrant Protection Protocol, which has been a pretty serious sidestep from what was previously being done, where people were coming in, passing their initial screening for asylum, and then being in the care of the Department of Homeland Security in an immigration detention center. The way that it works now is most people are actually camped out in refugee camps near the border in places like Nuevo Laredo and Juarez as they wait for the Department of Justice to send a bus down to get them, to bring them to their immigration proceedings and then take them back to Mexico. So it's called the Migrant Protection Protocol, but it's more the Remain in Mexico policy. And so there's thousands of people right now that are literally at our border in a refugee camp waiting for their day in court.
I know
that's not quite the number that you were looking for, but it's such a hard statistic to actually wrangle.
Well, no, I think that actually you're right. Here's my thinking as I'm thinking about you going through this. I know some American dollars, some taxpayer dollars are going to help those people and keep them alive and try to keep them safe. Probably not enough, but then I go back to a statement you made earlier that we don't have enough support in our immigration courts. We don't have enough judges. We don't have enough attorneys. We don't have enough support staff. And I guess I'm just thinking about the math. Would it be less expensive to expand the capacity of our immigration courts than pay every bill every day for 2,000 people waiting on the border to come into this country for 10 years?
That's an excellent point. That's an excellent point, Jim. And it would be, at least as far as my math shakes out on that, too. Because, you know, if we have people who are waiting in immigration detention facilities for, 200 days at $180 a day, which that is a real statistic, or you have people who are waiting in line for years and years to come into the United States from outside, that we're losing money on so many different levels of this. The Department of Justice not being able to adjudicate that many petitions, that further enforces the hopelessness of people who are in the United States who are not able to get a work visa or have another type of immigration relief too. So that puts them in this kind of secondary underclass sort of shadow economy that's no good for anybody. Mm-hmm. So you're right, the economic implications of this problem are extreme.
Phil, what happens to people who are in the country illegally and for lack of knowledge on my own part and they get caught? What happens to them?
Yeah, so I think it's worth stating that just because I feel like a lot of people don't know how many people are actually in the country illegally. We have almost 12 million people in the United States illegally right now. So that's such a sizable portion of such a sizable portion of our overall population that people get frequently picked up for minor crimes, traffic violations and the like, and they get run through the system and the police realizes like, oh, this guy doesn't have any paperwork. He's not a U.S. citizen. And they get put in immigration proceedings. From there, the immigration court would look to see if there was any type of relief that they might be eligible for, and then from there proceed to deport them.
And how long does that process take?
Well, it depends on the case. It can take years. It can take a matter of a few months. So many people go through the immigration court system unrepresented that they're not sure which systems or which processes they need to fight, which processes they need to push back on, and can get railroaded by the system and basically deported in 2 or 3 months. For a person that's represented that puts together a full case would take a year or two. But the bureaucratic inefficiencies of the current immigration court system are such that cases are moved around. With the current COVID situation, it's kind of impossible to say how it's going to shake out with putting that many people in a courtroom in the near future. So we expect long delays for people who are moving through the immigration court system going forward.
Mm. Well, you've said a couple things today that I think really are profound and something to think about, you know, trying to establish a way to have temporary work visas issued more quickly, allow more people to work. You've already noted that when that was available, that really reduced the number of people that were illegally coming into the country. We've also talked about the need for support in immigration courts, and maybe there could be a shift from, you know, taking care of people on a daily basis and that expense for years and just getting them through the system quicker by having the ability to do that. Phil, I'm looking at the clock. I originally told you we were going to keep you till about 1:40, 1:45. Would you be able to stay with us until 2? Because I'd really have a lot more to ask you today. And do you think you could stay with us?
Sure. Yeah, I can stick around.
Well, I am so interested in this because this is a massive problem. I mean, this is not something that you can just snap your fingers and make go away. There's people a lot smarter than me that have been working in this field, and that's why I wanted to call you, Phil, because you had perceptions when you were going to law school, and you decided you wanted to go into immigration law. You had perceptions at that time. How have your perceptions changed now that you have worked directly with immigrants?
Sure. Yeah, you're right to point out that there's a evolving perception that kind of happens when you get to study an area this complicated. I got interested in immigration law when I was living in Las Cruces. I went to NMSU and I studied journalism and Spanish there. And I was also sort of a student government nerd and an international traveler. So that cocktail really brought me to immigration law. As I've actually worked in the field and as I was going through my studies at UNM Law, I did a lot of sort of direct client representation, helping people figure out the system. A lot of times just helping people get their paperwork in order, and submitting it to whatever government bureaucracy it needs to go to. And then when I switched over to the government side, I saw how many people are actually making their way through the system. You know, like I said, there's 11 million people in the country illegally. That's an enormous amount of people to process in any system, and the way that it's being done behind the scenes is tremendously complicated and tremendously involved. So I think just having an appreciation for that scale was something that I definitely got out of working for both sides, both representing people in front of the government and working for the government. I think one other thing that I would say on that point is, you know, studying journalism and having an idea of the immigration law system and sort of seeing the obvious problems that were happening in borderlands and feeling like, okay, maybe journalism isn't the way I need to go. Maybe I should go be an immigration attorney and help these people. And then being an immigration attorney and helping people, seeing the policy side of immigration law and feeling like I wanted to kind of fix that and go address the bigger systemic policy issues. And then as I was working on bigger systemic policy issues, I come back and look and see that journalism is actually super, super important at the beginning of this spectrum. So it's sort of a big loop of information and the way that we use that information that has really called my attention to immigration law. And that's one of the reasons I'm so grateful for you having me on and for you putting on, you know, long form conversation about immigration, because I think it's one of those issues that you can just see the headlines that go down the party lines that you subscribe to, and you can have a very cemented idea of what immigration issues are. But when you really pull it apart, as we're doing in this long form conversation, you see how many different little threads there are and how complicated it all really is.
Well, and then on top of that, you have the people. You know, you don't just have rules and regulations. You have people that you care about and you develop relationships with. And I understand, Phil, that there's even people that serve in our United States military that are not United States citizens.
Yeah. Well, that's such a good point. And that's another thing that being in the immigration court showed me, was that every person, every situation is different. And if you paint with too broad a brush, which is easy to do when you're talking about these kind of numbers, you lose sight of the individuals and the needs and the motivations that they have for fleeing their country or for coming to this one. So I think that's a very good point about the individual aspect of it. As far as folks that serve in the military, yeah, that's kind of a crazy loophole. There's that's a short way to bypass a lot of the lines that exist for getting your green card. And we can talk about the sort of problematic nature of recruiting people for our military based on their motivations to get a green card as opposed to true patriotic motivations, if you want to go down that rabbit hole. But yeah, that's its own can of worms.
Well, and I mean, I understand that there are disabled former veterans of each branch of our services that are not United States citizens that maybe their paperwork should have been accelerated. Maybe that is a good program. And there's always going to be people. One of the things I've learned recently, Phil, is I took a course called Constitution 101 through a university called Hillsdale College. They offer the courses free online. Anybody can go to Hillsdale College and take a look at these free courses. I highly recommend the Constitution 101. But what I learned about the founding fathers of our country is that they recognized human nature. And you were raised in a Christian school. I don't know how long you went to Hope, but my kids were all lifers there. I seem to remember back when you were six, seven years old, we were playing basketball with you. So my memory's fading, though, because I'm over 60, Phil. The reason I bring this up is that our forefathers, the founders of our country, they were flawed people. You know, we brought up that Thomas Jefferson, he wrote, you know, the first couple lines in the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, and yet he was a slaveholder. 41 people that signed the Declaration of Independence were slaveholders. 15 were not. So these were people that believed in inequality. They put a document together that's got to be, if not the most famous document in the world, it may be only second to the Bible. And yet they themselves had shortcomings and flaws, and they were, I guess I can use the word sin. And what you're talking about is exactly the same thing. There are brilliant enough people, Phil Davies may be one of those, that could come up with an immigration policy that might work and take less than 10 years and might attract people in the United States military for the right reason. I mean, the people I know that have not immigrated to this country, that have served in our armed forces, have had amazing careers. It's almost like it's in their blood. They want to take care of us. They want to protect our borders. They want to protect America. And, you know, this whole, you know, melting pot thing that we've had in the United States, bringing people from all different walks of life from different countries around the world, that seems to me to still be a pretty cool thing. And I guess I'd love to see jobs coming back into America. I'm one of those people that, and I don't mind saying it, you know, I look at some things like the North American Free Trade Agreement. I personally think that's the dumbest piece of legislation ever. You know, that exported more jobs out of the United States than I can even imagine. And I'm still wondering today why we don't try to bring those jobs back into this country. And I think there are some politicians that want to do that, but everything's delayed. You know, it's like we have a lot of the black community that is up in arms because of issues that have happened in recent months. But what's really worn them out is to think about how long we've talked about equality. All men are created equal and all have the opportunity for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, yet they feel discriminated against. I get that because, you know, just the founding fathers wrote this great language in the Declaration of Independence, but it took 80 plus years before the slaves were even freed in this country. So I understand why there's frustration, but at the same time, this is the greatest country in the world. We've got more freedoms here than anywhere in the world. We have more protections. We have more opportunities. And, you know, as a Christian person, I would hope that that would become the focus, the excellence of our country. Not that we don't need to address the bad things, but we need to come together. And that's the other thing. We can't live without each other. We need to do this together. Phil, I want to ask you about, is it possible to enter this country legally without the process taking many years?
Yeah, I mean, I would hope so. I think just one thing I wanted to add to that wonderful tangent was the, you know, I think that there's this, in the Christian ethic, when we're thinking about immigration, I feel that there's this real duel that happens between justice and mercy. And that's something that you see in the Bible all the time, where it's, you know, whether we're going to enforce the law strictly to everyone always as a general rule of law, stability as laid out in Exodus and the other Old Testament books on governance, versus, you know, Christ's message of love and mercy and particularly how we should treat the stranger, that really comes into conflict all the time when we're talking about immigration law. And so having some idea of what our obligations are, not just to set up a stable governance in line with our foundations as a Christian nation, but also to meet and welcome our humanitarian needs to people who need love, need support, need safety, is an ongoing conversation that needs to be had and needs to be had honestly. So I really appreciate what you had to say about that. As far as how long, if we could set up a system that would allow people to come into the United States without having these tremendous backlogs, yeah, I think we can. I think we totally can. I think that there's this idea that the melting pot will be will become overrun, that we'll have, this nation of immigrants will have too many immigrants for its own good if we allowed all the people who were currently on the visa waiting list to have those visas approved, have those caps lifted, and those people come in. I just don't really agree with. I don't really see the support for that. I think that we're a nation of immigrants. We're a nation of you know, of problems, as you've alluded to with Thomas Jefferson and the way that slavery was instituted in our country, and the way that so much of our all of our land was taken from Native Americans at some point. There's this real interesting mix of things that make America special and uniquely hospitable to immigrants if we choose to embrace that side of our history. And that's the side of history that I choose to embrace. I think eliminating some of the government bureaucracies that we have, and eliminating some of the caps that we have for the people that are already in line with the right qualifications, with no criminal record, with all the medical vaccinations that we require, eliminating the caps on those folks and letting them in so they're not waiting for years and years and years at a chance to reunite with their family is something that I very much support.
Phil, we've got to take one more break. We're going to have a short 5-6 minute segment with you when we come back. Stay with us. More on ABQ Connect.
New Mexico, we love it, but it's no secret our state is left behind in some very vital social issues. Child hunger, single parents, and abortion, to name a few. The people of God can and must take action. That's what Mission New Mexico is all about at KNKT and Star 88. This month, featuring Landel Benally of Calvary Chapel Tolokai on the Navajo Nation.
It's very encouraging when you pull up at a house and these elders or these kids come running out to you, and just to see the joy in their eyes to receive the food, it's really uplifting, and it encourages you because you're doing it for a purpose.
That's Landel Benally of Calvary Chapel Tolokai on the Navajo Nation, this month's Mission New Mexico. Loving our neighbors in practical and productive ways is Christianity 101. At KNKT and Star 88, we are a megaphone for New Mexico needs as we provide a clear call to action. Find out more about supporting the work of Calvary Chapel Tolokai by clicking the Mission New Mexico tab at knkt.com or star88.fm.
Hi, this is Adam Holtz, and you're listening to Plugged In.
Air escort to Greyhound. You will now be out of range of air cover for the next 5 days.
The new movie Greyhound, now streaming on Apple TV Plus, stars Tom Hanks as the captain of a naval destroyer in World War II. His assignment? Escorting supply ships across the Atlantic to protect them from Germany's lurking U-boat submarines. Captain Krause is a man of deep character whose life is marked by faith and prayer. He walks the bridge of his ship until his feet literally bleed. And speaking of blood, we don't see too much in this intense but restrained PG-13 war movie. A lone harsh profanity is the worst of it. So we're giving Greyhound a 3 out of 5 for family friendliness. Read the full review at PluggedIn.com/radio. Plugging you into the movies, I'm Adam Holtz for Focus on the Family's Plugged In Movie Review.
You're listening to KNKT. Welcome back to ABQ Connect with Jim Williams.
Immigration attorney Phil Davies on the phone with us this afternoon. Phil, I've got a notepad just full of literally 100 things that you've said, and it's pretty amazing. But I want to go back to something that you said earlier in the first half of our program about maybe one solution is to go to these countries in Central America where so many of them are fleeing to the United States and address some of the systemic problems there. Are those problems with the government? Are they problems with they just don't have any jobs? How could we help these countries?
Yeah, that's a really important point, and you're right to go back to it, I think, because, you know, we do have a history of intervention in Central America in less than successful ways. The problems that we see most people fleeing Northern Triangle states, meaning Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, is that there is systemic corruption that allows drug cartels and gangs to basically run whole towns and neighborhoods, and have free reign to extort folks and to recruit people for violence and for trafficking purposes. So it's one of those things where the goal would ultimately be to root out these drugs, and trafficking gangs and their ties within the governments of these states, so that these places could be free to set up enterprises that could be successful and could be free to set up systems of law that are actually effective, where people could report violent crimes that happened to them to the police without fear of the police working with gangs for further retribution and things like that.
Well, I want to go back to this nature of man thing. I remember in the last 6 months, I've read a lot of articles about people like George Washington. George Washington was so popular in this country that he could have been the king of America. and mm-hmm. yet realizing the nature of man and wanting to have a government that was really representative of the people, have this be a republic, he would not do that. You know, he served as president, and then he stepped aside and wanted, you know, others to take that mantle and move forward. 8 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence and still a slaveholder, Thomas Jefferson wrote an article to the Assembly of Virginia in which he said that there were three bad things about slavery. One, the slaves would hate this country and so would their children. Number two, and I think it's important to what we're talking about, is when you're a slave owner, you become a tyrant and you become insensitive to the needs of other people because you're lording over someone else's life. And it seems like that is what has happened in Central America because they've allowed it to happen. So now there are people just, you know, slavery in this country was one thing, but when you start talking about human trafficking and sex slaves and all of this stuff, their countries are really in dire straits.
Yes, yes, totally. And it's such a complicated problem that I think that we should resist the temptation to ride in on our golden horse and go and fix everything. But I think there's some concrete steps that the United States could take to help train and help root out corruption within the government to establish some type of rule of law in which the gangs and the cartels are held accountable. And I think that should be a priority.
Well, again, not a simple, easy answer. Going to take a lot of pain, but you know, I know that people that are led by God, particularly, are long suffering and persevering. And if anything, our listeners can do is be praying for all of these issues. Phil, in your work, how can our listeners help you?
Sure. So, I mean, obviously, Raices runs primarily on donations. So if you feel compelled to support me in the work that I'm doing and the work that our organization is doing, you can go over to our website, raicestexas.org. There are also really great organizations in New Mexico. New Mexico Immigrant Law Center is one in Albuquerque. I've got several friends that went through the same UNM law program that I did who are doing great work over there. So if you feel like supporting financially over there or volunteering your time, you know, people need translation services, people need humanitarian services at New Mexico Immigrant Law Center. If you feel so compelled, there's endless ways to get involved with places like that.
Phil, I was so impressed. You and my older son are very close friends, and I know you still stay in contact, which I appreciate because you're an encouragement to him just hearing from you. But I was so impressed with you guys learned a lot about Spanish at Hope Christian School. And
yeah.
I'm just one of those people that thinks that's what all kids should be doing from the time they start school is bilingual education. And it doesn't necessarily have to be Spanish, English, it could be French, and whatever it is. You guys seem to be so much smarter because you're bilingual. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, it definitely teaches you to think a little bit differently too. When you have to really put together a phrase in a different language, it forces you to look at the language a little bit more critically. And I think that really improves your mental capacity. I couldn't agree more, though. If I would have had a bilingual education starting at a really young age, you know, I could have saved myself years of embarrassing gringo Spanish in different parts of Latin America.
I've spent a little bit of time up in Westgate Heights in Albuquerque at an elementary school there. I had the fortune of going to meeting a teacher who was a bilingual teacher. She didn't speak English real well, but let me tell you, she had a little Jewish boy and a little white boy and several black children and some Asian kids. And you would listen to them speak English and they spoke it perfectly. And then she asked them to demonstrate Spanish for me. And I mean, they sounded like they've been speaking Spanish their whole life and they're 8 years old. Brilliant stuff. Hey, yeah. Phil Davies, I am so appreciative of you. Phil is an immigration attorney with Raices Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services. Thank you for joining us today on ABQ Connect.
Thank you.
Jim Williams is a production of KNKT. The views expressed on ABQ Connect do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of KNKT. If you missed any or part of today's show, get the free podcast at abqconnect.online.